So we'll move on to our last presenter of the morning, at least in this venue. And it's Chris Spanos from the Red Eye Collective, and I believe... yay! And he's brought his own cheerleading squad, which is good. Typical. Of course he would. And radio's potential for democratic action.
I've been involved...
That shouldn't take too long.
Well... A bit of an expansion on my introduction. Been at Co-op Radio for about 4 years now, producing radio with the Red Eye Collective, and I've also been on the programming community as a current affairs representative for about a year and a half now. So that's my experience with radio. And I've done streeter stuff and live interviews and all that stuff. So I'm in it, and that's where I choose to be, is a cooperative radio station and in a collective format. So, yeah, the focus of my talk is radio's potential for democratic action, and I'm going to talk about radio's accessibility and use, both in understanding and participating in social and political life. But I also want to explore the opposite side of that coin, and that's the effects of concentration, but media concentration, but I don't want to get into a history of that or the fine details, because I think there's enough of that out there, but I just want to focus mainly on the human consequences. When I think about radio, I think about it as a two-way street. There are both consumers and producers of radio. By consumers, of course, I mean listeners, and by producers, I mean makers of radio. But, of course, those distinctions can be blurred. And at Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, and I imagine many community and campus stations as well, listeners can come on down and participate in the production of radio. And I know at Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, we pride ourselves on being a listener-owned and operated radio station. And as well, another way of blurring those distinctions is just through the formats of shows. Listeners can phone in and communicate with the producers of radio as well as with other listeners. And all that leads to what I think is radio's potential to foster rich and creative forms of communication. Contacts can be made, and awareness of neighbors both far and near becomes established. Our perceptions are broadened, and our capacities for social and political participation are deepened. Concentration of media ownership is already a deeply embedded fact in our daily lives, and I think it has become well established in our popular discourse. And most of us are probably familiar with the FCC deregulation happening in the United States right now, where it's focusing on the deregulation of cross ownership. And cross-ownership is the ability of a corporation to buy primary newspapers, radio, and television stations, as well as cable and internet service providers. Many Americans are saying that this issue will affect the future of film and music distribution, and basically what it determines is who will own creativity. And they're asking themselves a series of very important questions. How much news is infotainment? Where does reportage end and commercial begin? Are we watching this or that film or listening to this musician because the station is owned by the same company that releases the film and the CD and the newspaper that prints the glowing reviews? Will the internet that downloads this site become another broadcasting medium owned and controlled by the same company that owns the cable and the content? And I think we all understand the implications of those kinds of questions and the seriousness of it. The irony for me, when I look down there and I get, appalled by what's happening, is the shocking fact that a lot of them look to us as an example and an expert in this field of cross-ownership. And it's already, like, we're well beyond anything that they're thinking about. Yeah. They look to Canwest Global and Bell Globe Media's ownership of most of Canadians' news media as a good thing, and they see it as positive in a way to cut overhead and share resources and whatnot. But again, I think there's disastrous consequences to this and in particular human consequences, and I want to look more at very recent events that have taken place, and of course one of those is the war on Iraq. A lot of Americans supported the war, and I think that was only possible through mainstream media. Just prior, in the lead-up to the war, 86% people believe that Saddam Hussein was supporting terrorist activities, and another 53% believe that Saddam was, in fact, involved in the September 11th terrorist attacks. And, of course, none of that has been established, and much of it disproven. And it was community and campus cooperative radio stations that did report on those, the discrediting of those allegations, and also foreign media. But I think what's important for us in Canada is the perception that's relayed to us about our identity and our history and the role that we play in the world and how that, in fact, impacts our daily lives. So Canada's role in the war has largely remained unreported, and that has been due to a narrow spectrum of discussion within the Canadian media, who is well beyond the cross-ownership and concentration of U.S. media. So it's a very difficult thing to look beyond, and it really is independent media and community and campus media that do allow for leaks of this kind of information. But it wasn't reported widely at all that Canada provided military planners for months leading up to the war, and that we provided 25 personnel to the U.S. CENTCOM in Qatar, that Canada commanded the multinational naval force, and that there were 1,300 troops participating in Operation Apollo, and that there were exchange troops in there, and this was like the controversy. This was the total limit to the discussion in Canadian media, was the exchange troops that were over there, and were they participating and were they not? But it's like these exchange programs have existed for years and have allowed for Canadian participation in unofficial wars for well beyond this particular one. It's allowed for participation in this one, but it's been happening well before this war. Also, Canadian troops went to Afghanistan to free up U.S. troops to go to Iraq to wage war, and as well as public declarations in support of the U.S. war. And all this continues to dramatically shape our daily experience, and since 9/11, Canada has participated in increased racial profiling, most recently the arrest of 19 Indian and Pakistani immigrants that were arrested in suspicion that they might have something to do with terrorism. And apparently they have connections to a province in Pakistan noted for Sunni extremism. It's kind of hard just not to just call it blatant racism, and in fact it is. But I think there's lots of those examples and whatnot, but I think the larger issue is just the general pattern, the system that allows that to take place, that's behind that. And I think George Orwell is very astute in his observations, and he had a dictum that illustrates the dilemma, and that is, who controls the past controls the future, who controls the present controls the past. And I think this quote's important, as I interpret it, as meaning that where there's private ownership and control of communication, our perceptions of the past, our expectations of the present and future, our values and thinking are all shaped for subservience of power. As I mentioned earlier, radio has the potential to foster rich and creative communication, a communication that is empowering rather than disempowering, a communication that reflects our values, our perceptions, and our own ordering of our own thoughts. And luckily, as a listener, I do think radio is easily available. The question came up about listenability in other countries, Africa specifically. Studies done in other countries do indicate that it is possible to listen to radio, and one has been in Afghanistan. War-torn country, 70% illiteracy rate, 85% among women, and the majority of Afghanis live in villages. Electricity and telecommunications is virtually non-existent. However, most Afghanis do have access to and are able to listen to radio. Most of their news comes from international sources. So I think it's actually an understatement to say that the ability to listen to radio is at least as accessible here as it is in Afghanistan. The question is how is it going to be used? Will it be used in the service of shaping perceptions and to support that underlying structure that allows that to happen? Or will it be used in the service of developing capacities for rich communication that allows for participation in social and political life? I've tried to demonstrate radio's accessibility, and I've also tried to explore the human consequences of media concentration. And I believe radio still has vast amounts of untapped potential, and that community, campus, and cooperative structures simultaneously tap this potential and counter media hegemony. These structures could organize. I mean, when I look to the future as something that counters media hegemony, and I look at our own participation in the structures, and we talk about issues of inclusion, I think issues of inclusion are what people identify with as soon as they walk into the institution, but it's also how we empower people or disempower them as they walk beyond the doors and into the control room and leave throughout the week to share information about what's being produced, how it's being produced. All those things are part of the inclusivity discussion. And I think these structures could organize into federations. These could be organized into decentralized participatory collectives and councils and humane values of compassion, equity, and diversity could allow for a more radical subjectivity of how we perceive the world around us and how we participate in it. And it's through those forms and those structures and in those ways that I think radio can realize its full potential for democratic action.
Thanks very much, Chris.